Welcome to Techno Roll, a special Let It Roll maxi series discussing Michelangelo Matos's book, The Underground is Massive: How Electronic Dance Music Conquered America, hosted by Nate Wilcox and Ryan Artness. Let It Roll is the insanely ambitious musical history podcast. We've covered the early history of rock and roll, country music in the 20th century, the rise of hip-hop, disco, and electronic dance music, and now heavy metal. Stay tuned for our histories of Broadway, opera, punk rock, jazz, blues, and gospel. Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter, at Let It Roll Cast, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com. Today, Nate and Ryan discuss the turn of the millennium, 9/11, mashups, electroclash, and the era when Vice magazine laid down the laws of hipsterdom. Email us at letitrollpodcast@gmail.com. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy.
It's time to Let It Roll, or shall I say Techno Roll? That's right, I'm your host, Nate Wilcox, joined once again by Ryan Harkness to continue our discussion of The Underground is Massive, How Electronic Dance Music Conquered America. And Ryan, we've left the 20th century behind. We're entering a decade some of us are trying to call the noughties.
Yeah, it's it's like now we're getting into the 2000s. And of course, we got to start with the big bummer that is 9/11, which happens kind of right in the middle of this episode and just bums everything out.
Yep. Although there's plenty of other things to be bummed about, too. I'm not going to bag on this stuff. I've actually enjoyed the listening for this show quite a bit. But I have to admit, a lot of painful memories come back when I think about this era that are totally tied into this music.
Yeah, I mean, it's a time of churn. Rave is on a downslide. Rave has gone completely underground and insular. Club music has gone completely plastic. The whole thing is wannabe corporate with cell phone and liquor sponsorships and everybody trying to get that money. There's no more society, as Margaret Thatcher said. We're done with that. It's all people looking to be standout individuals. So it's a bit of a confusing time for sure for the scene.
Yep, and a lot of big technological things are happening. And Matos starts the chapter with a discussion or an anecdote of Josh Wink getting caught DJing with no records. And Josh Glazer, who's the witness of that, is like, really? So there's new technology out there that is letting DJs replace their vinyl records, which vinyl survived all the way through the 90s. In retrospect, it's really kind of amazing that analog vinyl technology was the dominant form for dance floor mixing that long.
Yeah, I mean, there was just nothing else. I mean, I think the book mentioned that the Pioneer DJ 1000 came out basically in like 2000, 2001. And that was when the tipping point kind of happened. But it was still very slow because let me tell you what, as a person who played CDs, you got a lot of crap for it. If you weren't playing on turntables, people just got used to the idea of turntables being cool. So all of a sudden you show up with a rack mount CDJ and people were not impressed.
And even less impressive was laptops when people started DJing with those and there was new technology. Let's see, what is it? Ableton was the software that came out and allowed DJs to mix right there on their laptops or play stuff they'd already recorded and check their email while everybody's rocking on the dance floor.
Yeah, there were people who could really rock a show with Final Scratch or Ableton, and then there was a lot of people who were just using it because they, you know, had no comfort outside of a computer setup. So there was a big reputation for laptop DJs to be boring, and that's because a lot of them were. We've kind of gone past that now at this point, but you know, even now you'll go to events and you'll still see people who are like, you know, just staring at a screen blankly rather than interacting with the crowd or, you know, picking up the vibe.
Yeah, and Matos does have an interesting anecdote that John Aquaviva and Richie Houghton of Plus 8 Records Aquaviva was the one who first got into it, that he, in early 2001, recorded a mix CD using club monitors and a laptop that he was actually using a DJ. And that was, you know, a secret. But Josh Glazer likes it, comes up to him and was like, I know your secret. And Aquaviva was like, you want to try it? He was an evangelist. It turns out he was an investor. Final Scratch was the tool he was using. It was first developed in Amsterdam in 1999. Aquaviva heard about it, flew over there and invested. And then Final Scratch hits the market in January 2002. And then Richie Hawtin releases a whole album, DE9: Closer to the Edit, that's, quote, a mix album featuring more than 70 tracks broken down into 300 loops, each 1 to 4 bars long, arranged into 53 continuous minutes. Like, listening to it, to me, it sounds like sort of an intelligent techno or intelligent drum and bass style record. Explain what's going on here. Why is this some sort of technical breakthrough?
Well, it's basically, instead of just having individual tracks that you're trying to kind of do transitions with, all of a sudden you're able to take these tracks and break them down into specific loops from specific sections. And with Ableton, it's designed explicitly so that you can drop all of these into one button press loops. So at any point in time, you can have 5 or 6 different loops going from 5 or 6 different tracks. It just completely opens the door to complete flexibility. And of course, is that flexibility actually necessary? You know, a lot of these producers spend a lot of time painstakingly perfecting these tracks, only to have a DJ play half a minute of it before mixing it out, or now just, you know, taking one loop, putting it into Ableton and running it for 5 minutes with like 3 other tracks. So it's controversy, you know, and as you could tell from reading the chapter, there's a lot of suspicion from everybody that catches anybody doing anything other than playing vinyl, because up until this point, the expectation is if you have a computer or a CD hooked up to this thing, then you've just pressed play and that's it.
And so was Houghton's idea that this would empower DJs who were using Ableton to manipulate his tracks with more flexibility off this record?
You know, the DJ or the producer never wants their tracks to be the ones that are manipulated typically, you know, that's the whole thing, but it does offer a whole other level of control. You know, Houghton, I think, was at his peak when he was kind of messing around like this. His Dex Effects and 909s was a step towards this. And this was like about as close as he ever got to what you could consider live remixing. And again, it's just, it's kind of a different way of playing. It's a different result. And whether or not you're into that or not, you know, depends on your personal taste.
Is it fair to say that Richie Hawtin has had one of the most consistently productive and innovative careers of any DJ in the 90s? Because we've been talking about him for episode, I mean, ever since the second wave of Detroit techno. And it seems like he is continuing to innovate and come up in these narratives for good reason. Whereas, you know, you compare him with somebody like Aphex Twin, who maybe had 2 or 3 phases, but then kind of fades away into his own little cul-de-sac. Is that unfair?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, it's competition too. Like, this is a book on the American rave scene, and Richie Hawtin was definitely one of the most innovative guys in North America doing all this stuff. And he was definitely pushing things from, you know, 95 to 2005. Now he's kind of settled down a little bit. But yeah, he was definitely right on the forefront of a lot of the exciting things going on for, you know, over a decade.
And I'm going to play our first song, and I'm going to switch the order, actually, because what we're about to talk about is this next song. This is Kid 606, A Cat Step, My Kitten, Catnap Vatst. What's the name of the song?
Yeah, that's it.
Okay. All right. Kid 606, Cat Step, My Kitten, Catnap Vatst. We'll be right back. And that was Kid 606, Cat Step, My Kitten, Catnap, Vatsed. And Kid 606 comes into our narrative while Matos is talking about Ableton, because this is a period where you could replace the sampler with your laptop, and the laptop becomes an audio player. But that causes this, the stuff made on laptops has this new sound. It's kind of a crisp, computery flutter. And sometimes there are little sound problems and there are little glitches in the matrix that quickly becomes its own style. There's the Tiger Beat 6 label from San Francisco, and this guy Miguel De Pedro, aka Kid 606, is the avatar of this little scene. Tell us why you picked that track, or did I already spoil your whole thing?
I mean, you kind of did. I mean, it's I picked that specific one because it kind of embodies what Kid 606 was doing. The book labels it glitch. It's also kind of breakcore, and the key element to take away from it is that it took kind of some of the quote unquote more intelligent drum and bass, artistic kind of experimental stuff, and just started having fun with it again. I mean, you hear that track and it's ridiculous. And I think the whole point of everything that Kid 606 was doing was that he was, pulling intelligent drum and bass's head out of its ass again, and just throwing the rule book in the garbage too. So it was a lot of really strange stuff going on that Kid 606 was pushing and experimenting with, which is, and just a repudiation of being too serious about everything.
Yeah, and we've seen some of this sort of humorous stuff coming out, and some of the stuff we talked about in the Detroit episode, some of the stuff that was coming out of Detroit around that time is very tongue-in-cheek. I'm thinking of Sandwiches, of course. And it's also interesting to compare the way Reynolds talked about Kid 606 and this glitch break core scene versus the way Matos kind of just tucks it in here in this technological discussion and doesn't make too big a deal of it. Reynolds, it seemed like, was writing closer to the time, and not to disparage the great Simon Reynolds, but I think he has a bit of shiny object syndrome, where when somebody does something that's new and interesting to him, he's prone to maybe making more of a big deal out of it than it ultimately merits.
Well, you spend enough time in electronic music, anytime a purple cow comes along, it's very exciting, because I think that's the story of 2000, 2001, is that at this point, people are sick of, they're sick of house, they're sick of trance, they're sick of techno. Something has to give. Everything is kind of just boiled down to its most, boiled down to the most extreme rule sets possible. We're all straight jackets now, and these people have to come along and start shaking things up with both glitch, breakcore, and with electro.
Yep. And we'll talk about electro a lot more later, but now we're going to talk about the mashups. And this is something that's been going on since the 80s. I mean, you had people like Negative Land and Evolution Control Committee.
Jive Bunny and the Master Mixers.
Yep. All kinds of people were the Plunderphonic style or Sample Delica, made a big splash in the 80s. And then sort of faded, but in the early 2000s, the technology had reached a point. There's tons of hip hop artists. It's kind of become de rigueur for hip hop artists to put out a cappella versions of their stuff, so you can add, Jay-Z or whatever rapper to any track. And the technology's gotten better, so it's easier to swipe individual pieces from tracks, even if there are other things playing at the same time. And you can, pitch correct and speed correct and stuff. So you can blend a lot of things in ways that were not possible before. So you get acts like Too Many DJs, which is David and Stephen Diwala.
I'm not sure. I'm not sure. I can barely keep up with their artist names, like Too Many DJs, Soul Wax, everything else.
Yeah. So they're also known as Soul Wax, and they make a big splash. I mean, this is something that even penetrated my consciousness at the time, was things like Magnificent Romeo. I remember that one in particular. That was a combination of Romeo by Basement Jacks and the Magnificent Seven by The Clash. And, mashups at this point, when I see a mashup now, it's some boomer on Facebook that's found the most obvious, like, crikey, somebody mixed, I don't know, Slayer and Herb Alpert. This is the craziest. And it's like, is this not the craziest thing you've ever seen? It's a joke I already get. But it's kind of fun to go back and listen to Too Many DJs. It's actually pretty good music.
Yeah, well, the intensity was definitely there. I think what people appreciated about it was the lack of polish on it. We're getting to a point where things got pretty punk rock, and it no longer had to be clean and pristine. You were able to go in there and throw together this weird Dolly Parton mashup. The beats didn't quite match up perfectly, but that was okay because the energy was there, and it almost made it better because you could tell that it was being done live.
Yeah, and a ton of the energy is coming from these combinations and the way that they would tease snippets from a familiar song, then maybe go into the chorus, or maybe not, you know, like, oh, we thought, you know, you thought we were going to play Salt and Pepper's Push It, but actually we're going to go into The Stooges No Fun instead. And also it's stuff like listening to long, you know, their albums, mixed length albums, as heard on Radio Soul Wax Part 2 is one that Matos recommends to listen to. And I went all the way through. They bring in a lot of things, a lot of punk rock stuff like The Stooges or The Cramps that had never been massive hits, but had reached a pretty large audience, you know, like in the 35, 40 years at this point since The Stooges had come out, a lot of people were familiar with it. So it's kind of this victory lap for people coming from a punk rock perspective. And it fit right in with other things that were going on in this era, which included really kind of, to me, the inexplicable success of the White Stripes and the Strokes and this school of retro garage rock that's suddenly hip and cool. I mean, I enjoyed some of that music, but it was very strange because rocker fashion and what was actually hip and cool, like in gay dance circles, had been so far apart for so long. And then all of a sudden, all my gay friends are looking like rockers. And I'm like, you know, what's going on? Are rockers hip now? Or have you guys lost the plot? And so for a while, rockers were hip. It was a weird time.
Yeah. And it was, I think what really stuck out to me was the fact it was like the re-realization that rock music could be dance music, you know, like we talk about this a lot with like Northern Soul and stuff, where it's like, you know, you could, that had a really good beat to it and you could really dance to it. I feel like for a long time, rock music, people almost told you had to just stand there at the concert. Maybe you could mosh, but the idea of actually getting out and cutting it on the dance floor at a club to rock music was practically verboten. So now all of a sudden the flood doors are open again because they're adding, you know, four to the floor beats to this rock music, and they're bringing the dance and they're bringing the fun back.
And we'll talk about some of that specifically later, but let's go ahead and hear our second song. And this is Too Many DJs mashing up Dolly Parton's 9 to 5 and Roy's Cop's Epic or
Apple.
Apple. Okay, there you go.
Some Danish something or something. Who knows?
And Roy's Cop's Apple. This is Too Many DJs mashing it up. And that was Too Many DJs from the long form album as heard on Radio Soul Wax Part 2. This is a particular snippet combining Dolly Parton's 9 to 5 and Roy's Cop's Apple. Anything you want to add to that, or have I already spoiled your whole?
I think we basically kind of covered the general concept.
All right, cool. And yeah, I highly recommend it if you want to go back and listen to that stuff. He also mentions Greg Gillis, a.k.a. Girl Talk, who... As Mato says, it didn't take long for mashups to become a tedious grind, with Girl Talk eventually running it into the festival circuit ground. Although he does...
When he was hot, man, Girl Talk was hot, and it was always a good time. And, you know, I still feel like Girl Talk could come out and do that same set at a place that was ready to party. But again, it's, you know, after 10 years of something existing, it's just not fresh anymore. There's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah, and Matos does go out of his way to point out that the 2006 album Night Ripper is still a blast. And yeah, it's just, it was a fun idea at the time. Ultimately, yeah, got played out like anything else. But then he talks about another thing that's going on in this period, which is this two-way conversation with what's going on in pop and rock and hip hop. And he says, if, quote, if electronic dance music wouldn't cross over to America on its own, and we've already had the kind of electronica push with Prodigy and Chemical Brothers and Fatboy Slim individually making it big and Moby making it very big, but EDM did not become a dominant form of American popular music. It had these kind of one-off artists that fit into other categories, but so it says maybe it could become pop's sharpest trace element. And you get things like Madonna's Ray of Light album from 1998, where she works with William Orbit, who is a progressive house guy, co-founder of the Gorilla label. Then on the music album Madonna did in September 2000, she works with Stuart Price, which, and I was confused. So Stuart Price is AKA Jacques Leconte and Les Rhythmes Digitalis. So is Stuart Price a real person with these other names, or?
Les Rhythmes Digitalis has Jacques Leconte in it, and Jacques Leconte is Stuart Price.
I see. Okay. Okay. So at the same time, or very close to the same time, October 2000, Radiohead puts out Kid A, which Matos says is heavily and unmistakably indebted to the Warp catalog, which is, of course, the intelligent
bleep and bass.
Yeah, bleep and bass, the dreaded intelligent techno that Simon Reynolds heaped so much opprobrium on. Fittingly, Radiohead, probably my least favorite act, definitely of the 90s and 2000s, if not of all time. So, yeah.
Okay, we're not gonna get any accolades towards them in this series, I suppose.
I guess not, but Reynolds definitely. I'd love to read Reynolds panning Radiohead. Maybe Reynolds likes Radiohead. I don't know. It seems like every other critic loves Radiohead, and honestly, I have not given them a fair listen because I can't. But they also talk about, and many people love Radiohead, and much respect. There's nothing wrong with loving Radiohead, just not my cup of tea. But also at the same time, and I think this is a more interesting element, was that hip-hop groups like Outkast, on their Sankonia album, put out Bombs Over Baghdad, which Matos calls a wild fusion of acid rock guitar and jungle snare skids from Move in Shadow circa 1994. It's also a big Fotech, the intelligent drum and bass group from the late 90s, to me is the most obvious influence on that, which this was a huge hit in my world. I had no idea until I read this book that it barely charted R&B and didn't go pop at all. How did this happen? I thought Outkast was huge. Was this?
Yeah,
just...
no, this song was everywhere at the time, as far as I was concerned. Maybe it was just one of those weird ones where it got lots of radio play, but it just didn't sell. Another sign that you can't always just look at the charts to like accurately represent what's going on, I suppose, because it was, as far as I know, like everybody knows Bombs Over Baghdad.
Yeah, and maybe it was popular later when they had their next, you know, they put out another album after Stankonia that was even bigger. But yeah, this was so huge. And then in March 2001, Missy Elliott, produced by Timberland, puts out Get Your Freak On. That one goes number 7 pop, number 3 R&B. Matos calls it easily identifiable as drum and bass with the Asian-British electronic hybrid
Bhangra.
Bhangra?
Well, it's deleted from your sheet, so I'm
I
like,
know
oh,
it's
no.
Like I forgot I got fancy, you know how this stupid text program erases words, if and I forgot, I just got cocky and thought I could not teach it that word, and then it says no, you can't do that because it's going to erase the word. But Bhangra, and this was the thing, like Fatboy Slim's remix of Corner Shop, Brimful of Asher is an example of this, but also Talik Singh, I think, was big around this time. There was a lot. Yeah, obviously, England has a big South Asian population, and they were starting to make their presence felt, and their traditional music's coming in. And Timbaland definitely had his ears open to that and many other things. Plus, he's bringing in his own unique aspects. And to me, this is really kind of a moment when hip-hop, frankly, just stole the grail away from electronic dance music. They copped all of EDM's best stuff and put it into a format that was better. I mean, it was pop songs and dance floors. Is that just my imagination? But the way I remember this era is hip hop owned the dance floors, whether it was Missy Elliott or Outkast or Lil Jon. People
yeah, I mean, it was obviously the mainstream stuff. And you know, we talk about how they took a bunch of elements from dance music. I think to a certain degree, it's also just a sign of the times as far as the equipment that was being used. It was impossible for you know, dance music got the equipment first and was using a lot of it. And now all of a sudden you've got all this pop music and hip hop that's using the same drum machines and the same bass and the same synths and stuff like that. So it's kind of impossible, I felt, for other genres of music. Like to me, like all the pops kind of became electronic music because it was all just being produced with similar equipment. And yeah, I don't feel bad about hip hop beating out electronic music, or, you know, it's no different than pop, you know, being upset that pop music is bigger than electronic music, even though it's, you know, Madonna's basically taking trance music, taking progressive, taking house. So, you know, I've never considered it a stealing the lunch because I never expected electronic music to get, you know, to even have the blip that it had in 2006 to 2010, before it just became completely consumed by pop music completely. And it's now just pop music.
Yeah. And also so much of electronic dance music was influenced by hip hop in the first place. Hip hop, you know, starts in the late 70s, and things like hip house that we've talked about ad nauseum are enormous influences on jungle and drum and bass and everything else. Like hip hop got there first in a lot of ways. Electro, that we're going to be talking about later this episode, is also hip hop. So they're cousin genres anyway. So totally normal for the, you know, art forms to cross-pollinate. Then Matos goes back to Detroit to check in on the Detroit Electronic Music Festival. They do the second edition, May 26, 2001. And now he tells us that when it, you know, we did the DMF chapter a couple weeks ago, and at the end of the chapter, he has this, you know, it's this feel-good chapter. The Detroit heroes come home. They're friends and family come out, and they have this massively successful event that claimed it had 900,000 attendees. Now Mata says, well, that was grossly overreported. It was probably more like 100,000.
It all depends on how you count it. Like Electric Daisy Carnival, when they do like a 3-day or a 5-day in Las Vegas or whatever else like that, they every single day they count all the same people who came in the day before as a new person. So say over the weekend they had over 1 million people. That's because they had like 300,000 people coming in every single day, plus, you know, 1,000 kind of wanderers around. So DEMP is one of those things where, you know, over the course of the entire weekend, over the course of like through the city, you had like 1 million people kind of like, and you add it up again and again. So you kind of cheat a little bit. But I wouldn't be surprised if it was, you know, around 500,000 at least people who kind of, you know, 100,000 every day and, you know, an extra 100,000 just kind of like around the edges.
So they counted the audience the way that Google counts web visitors. So, yeah.
Yeah, very sketchily. Very, very much, however, is best that they can present it to sponsors.
And the reward comes in the form of Ford chipping in $435,000 to... you know, outfit the thing with giant screens and better sound system. But there's always a bummer. Carol Marvin, the City of Detroit person who helped Carl Craig set up the first one, fires Carl Craig just 15 days before the show. So there's a little bit of pushback. People are wearing I support Carl Craig buttons.
A little bit.
A lot. Yeah, people have banners that march into the whole thing. Kind of a big pushback. And also Derek May, who... he did end up playing at the first one, right? And but ends up not playing at this one because of a hailstorm. He was supposed to headline, but he ends up playing at the Works Club and plays a 5-hour legendary set. So I guess kind of a happy ending there. But let's take a quick sponsor break. When we come back, we'll talk about the reemergence of Electro.
Hello, Pantheon Podcast listeners. Christian Swain here to tell you more about my experience with Raycon earbuds. Our family now has 3 pairs of Raycon earbuds around the house, and my wife just grabbed a pair of the Headphone Pros to replace some headphones from a company that was double the price. And yes, she loves them. Now, if you haven't pulled the trigger on a pair of Raycons, or even if you have but you're in the market for another pair because they're just that good, well, now is the time to check them out, because they just launched their upgraded model of the best-selling everyday earbuds. With Raycon's upgraded everyday earbuds, now you also get active noise cancellation, ergonomic design, and multi-point connectivity that lets you pair with two devices at once. New quick charge function, three customizable sound styles, plus awareness mode. Available in a variety of vibrant new colors to complement any and all skin tones. I even have a pair of earbuds in a cool green color. I have tried just about every earbud known to humankind, and these Raycons are fantastic. Seriously, if you've been wanting to check out Raycons, there truly is no better time. You're going to ask yourself why you didn't check them out sooner, and Raycon offers a 30-day happiness guarantee. So, what are you waiting for? Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order, plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
Hey folks, Stefan Shirazi and Renee Richardson here from the Metallica Report.
And we are proud members of the Pantheon podcast family, where the best of music and podcasts unite.
We've got something pretty cool for you. We're giving away an exclusive Metallica merch package worth over $250.
That's a whole lot of scary guys, skulls, M72, and other sought-after Metallica swag. And we've made it easy for you to win. Follow and share the Metallica Report, and you're in the game. Go to pantheonpodcast.com/Metallica, enter your email, and hit that button to be entered to win.
And just like that, you're eligible for our monthly exclusive Metallica merch package.
And guess what, rockers? You can enter every month, so just do it. And while we love our global brothers and sisters, the lawyers won't let us ship outside the U.S.
All right, so I'm having a little dog mutiny, but sorry. And we're back. So the next thing that he goes into is Tommy Sunshine reemerges. And Tommy Sunshine's this character that we've Matos has used. He's popped up again and again at Storm Rave and even further. And he was involved with Disco Donnie and had moved to Atlanta. Now he meets up with this guy, Felix Stallings Jr., who Felix Stallings is somebody with impeccable house music credentials. Like when he was 14, he co-produces Fantasy Girl with DJ Pierre, the great DJ Pierre who invented acid house. They put out an album or a single, Fantasy Girl, as Pierre's Fantasy Club. Stallings meets up with Tommy Sunshine and is like, hey man, come back to Chicago and let's make some records together. And so Sunshine moves back to Chicago. Stallings' goal is he wanted to amalgamate all the musical styles from the late 70s leading up to house music, which to him meant Kraftwerk, Giorgio Moroder, Eurodisco, New Wave, and Electro. And Electro has been kind of this one genre of all the early 80s dance music things going on that had kind of been a dead end or seen as a dead end by the dance community. I mean, people like Two Live Crew kind of kept it alive. It pops up in Ghetto House and Booty House and stuff like that. And it's,
yeah, electro just got picked apart because you had the breakbeat element of it just taken wholesale for breakbeat. And then a lot of the synthesizers and stuff like that got pulled out and used in trance and techno. And there was just like electro sitting on its own back in the 80s with Planet Rock and stuff like that. There just wasn't too much left to it that hadn't already been stolen by somebody else.
Yeah. And it kind of it had this dynamic through the 90s where it started out corny, then got so corny it was cool, and then just became cool again. And so Felix the House Cat, this album he's working on with Tommy Sunshine, ends up being called Kittens and the Glitz because he's got like Carolyn Hervé, aka Miss Kitten, sings on it. And then there's this great story how Tommy Sunshine ends up writing lyrics for multiple songs, does it over the phone, which Matos is a really clever writer because he talked about how Sunshine in the last chapter, when Sunshine's working at the record store in Atlanta, how he would have to make his orders listening to things on speakerphone. So now he gets to hear a track on speakerphone or just on the phone and write the lyrics to it over the phone. So kind of anytime Matos introduces a gun in the first act, somebody's going to get shot is kind of the rule of thumb. He's not wasting any words. But this album, there's a whole team of people, Tommy Sunshine, Miss Kitten, Dave the Hustler, Harrison Crump, Junior Sanchez, Junior Jack, and Melistar. And it was originally supposed to be a group, aka Kittens and the Glitz. But the record label wanted Felix de Housecat to have a solo album, so it became a solo album. And Tommy Sunshine doesn't have a publishing deal, so he doesn't get any royalties for the songs he wrote lyrics for, despite, like, one of them, Silver Screen Shower Scene, goes top 40 in the UK and is on all kinds of compilations. So
I had no idea that he had anything to do with that track. And that's brutal because, yeah, Silver Screen was basically like one of the biggest anthems for this whole genre.
Yeah. So this is, you know, like Mick Jagger and Keith Richards say, yeah, our manager, Alan Klein, ripped us off, but he gave us an education in the music business, so we're not bitter about it because, you know, we lost millions and millions and millions, but we went on and learned. And Tommy Sunshine has that same view of, this was my education in the music business, won't happen again. He goes on to become a big time remixer and producer. And Felix, the house cat, goes on to an even bigger career. Like, he remixes Madonna's James Bond theme. He collaborates with P. Diddy. And Matos has a corny joke, and I got to repeat that, like, why did P. Diddy not rebrand himself as P. Did E during his fascination with electronic music? But anyway.
Oh, kind of like how Madonna, what was her Ecstasy album called again? Like, she completely, God. Oh yeah, that is Molly, yeah, something. I mean,
yeah, she had the whole Is Molly in the House thing at some big festival that, you know, just embarrassed everybody. Yeah, it's anytime you're 50 something year old, you know, Gilf shows up at the party talking about drugs, it's like, let's go to a different party.
P. Diddy definitely was smart keeping it keeping it in the hip hop scene.
Yeah.
Less tumultuous, ironically.
Indeed. And then we kind of get to the meat, the narrative meat of the chapter, which is, you know, this is the Electro Clash era. And if you'll recall, when Simon Reynolds talked about this period, like I said, he talked about Breakcore and the Glitch stuff quite a bit, but he was really fascinated with the Electro Clash thing. And there's a lot of factors going into this. One of the factors is that Manhattan just suddenly dies as a hub, a scene. I mean, Rudy Giuliani's the mayor and he's cracking down on the clubs. The club scene in New York has, you can't argue that it got out of hand and got awful. You know, you had murders and drug overdoses, and, you know, you had the Twilo Club had their own private ambulance service that was trying to sneak ODs off to a hospital without the police noticing. Sasha and Digweed were playing endless progressive house sets. And
but it deserves to die just for that reason alone. Yeah.
Why does everybody hate him so much? But, you know,
it's just a representation of the excess that the whole progressive scene represented at the end.
Yeah. And so, you know, the clubs in Manhattan just dry up. Manhattan becomes unaffordable. People start moving out to Brooklyn, which later becomes unaffordable. But at this point in time, Williamsburg in particular was quite affordable. And Williamsburg, I mean, the idea of Williamsburg becoming a gentrified hip center, this is where the Goodfellas guys came from. This is where the Murder Incorporated guys came from back in the 40s. So this is a historically rough neighborhood that suddenly becomes the place where hipsters from Seattle move to and make Electro Clash albums. And so he starts talking about Larry T is kind of his main character for this section. And you know, Larry T had been involved in the height of the decadence in the New York club scene in the 90s. He co-founded Disco 2000 with the infamous Michael Alig. He co-wrote RuPaul's Supermodel, You Better Work, in 1993. But by the turn of the millennium, he's tired of the overblown super clubs and starts playing little electro parties in Brooklyn, first at Spencer Products House. And then, you know, DJ Hell of Germany, and we talked about him quite a bit in the Reynolds episode that covered this, he gets interested, plays T and Products Night at the Pyramid. Explain my notes to me. What happened there?
Well, just he came over and checked it out and liked what he saw. So that's okay. All I see.
I see. Okay. And then he puts out Frank Sinatra by Miss Kitten and the Hactor, not to be confused with the Miss Kitten album we just talked about. But that's on the international DJ Gigolo Records label that DJ Hell has. And then this group comes along, Fisher Spooner, the group that best exemplified Larry T's vision for where this stuff could go. And it's Casey Spooner, a singer, and Warren Fisher, a synth player. And Fisher's an ex-indie rocker. Like, he'd been in a, not quite a Slint cover band, but a massive, you know, he was way into the indie rock thing. But now all of a sudden there's
past this indie rock into math rock.
Yes. He stuck with it far enough into math rock. and then senses the zeitgeist and goes in this totally different direction. They had met when they were art students in Chicago. They reconnect in New York City in spring of 98. August 25th, 1998, they debut at the Astor Place Starbucks. Matos has to say, I'm not kidding about this. Like, and immediately their shows are super attention grabbing and over the top. Like, Spinner's wearing a human hair suit for their second show. They recorded a set at Brooklyn's Rare Book Room. Emerge, their first single, is released on John Selway's Serotonin label in a very unique deal. Only had a 6-month license, could only put out 1,000 copies of vinyl. DJ Hell gets so excited about him, even though he doesn't like the record. He liked the photos of the shows he had seen so much that he books him to come and play in Berlin.
Yeah, these guys kind of end up being the new Rabbit in the Moon, because they've got this ridiculous show with a whole bunch of costume changes and everything else like that. And if you want to kind of imagine what's going on, it's kind of it's a Rocky Horror Picture Show meets burlesque show meets a drag show. It's like a whole production, and it's
with
very
a punk rock vibe.
Very much punk rock.
Confrontational, kind of in your face. And they're changing basically on the edge of the stage. Like, they're showing you the strings holding them up, but they're also connected to the art scene in a big way. The big money, real time New York art scene. They perform at an installation at Gavin Brown's Enterprise. The piece was called Apartment 21 by a guy named Rukrit Tiruvaniya. I'm sure I'm mispronouncing that. Apologies. But this was a thing where the guy put his apartment into, a gallery show and sort of let people live there. People recorded albums. Somebody shot a porno there during the course of the set, and Fisher Spooner played a set. So this is a very unique time in human history.
Yeah, this is kind of New York is developing another like Warhol era, where it's like a mix of performance art, musical and otherwise, like, and it's all kind of meeting together in this kind of new, fun, exciting, unserious but also very serious scene.
And now we're going to play our next track, which is kind of a non sequitur because we already talked about this, but this is Felix the House Cat and featuring Miss Kitten doing Silver Screen Shower Scene with lyrics by Tommy Sunshine.
Speed seduction in the magazine, endless pleasure in limousine, in the back shakes a tambourine, nicotine from a silver screen. Speed seduction in the magazine, endless pleasure in limousine, in the back shakes a tambourine, nicotine from a silver screen.
And that was Felix the House Cat and Miss Kitten doing Silver Screen Shower Scene. Do we need to talk about it anymore? We already people.
Yeah, no, it's in there because I didn't get it in on the last Electro episode. And it's got to be in there, especially with the story about Tommy Sunshine get ripped off. So continue.
Yes. And so back to Fisher Spooner, you know, they get their own show. Gavin Brown, the guy who had produced, put on the Apartment 21 art show, gave them their own show in March 2000. And, you know, they're doing 5 nights straight, 4 shows a night, have a whole troupe of female dancers and, you know, ridiculous costumes and military boots and corsets and stuff. And Matos quote has this quote from Elizabeth Vincentelli, who's the music editor of Time Out New York, which is back when it was a thing back in the 90s. Says Fisher Spooner was playing a dangerous role because as soon as you start associating with the fashion industry, you're fucked. The fashion industry has nothing to lose. And it's not just the fashion industry. It's also the serious art industry. So they're basically, I mean, anytime anybody has done this, the only people in pop music that I can think of that seriously went after the art or had deep connections in the art community, I think of the Velvet Underground with their partnership with Andy Warhol, also their connections in the avant-garde classical scene. Yoko Ono had those same kind of connections with the avant-garde music scene, but she didn't, and with the art world, art gallery artist. Both of those groups triggered, you know, Yoko and the Velvet Underground definitely triggered massive backlashes. I think over time, people definitely came to appreciate Velvet Underground. I mean, all punk and new wave kind of traces back to that. Yoko Ono has a lot of people have come to appreciate her music as well. But both of those acts were hated by hippies and the music mainstream of the 60s. So it's a dangerous thing. And then
yeah, and you got to remember, it's also out with the old, in with the new, as far as the fashion people are concerned. If you're, you know, once you're no longer hip and cool, and it's going to happen, and it's going to happen sooner than you expect, then all of a sudden, all of the air gets sucked out from underneath you, and you're being labeled as last year's news. And that's like, yeah, it's bad. It's a bad idea to hook yourself up to a scene that's so obsessed with whatever's on the cutting edge.
Yeah, with the transient. But at the same time, you got to applaud their ambition. And for a hot minute there in the early 2000s, it seemed like Fisher Spooner had squared the circle and united dance music, pop music, fashion, and the art world, which, you know, it certainly had the people of Manhattan talking. And then one of the other characters that Matos talks about is this guy, Jake Shears, a.k.a. Jason Sellards. And he's the guy who had moved to Williamsburg from Seattle, puts together a group called Hungry Wives, has their one hit, It's Over. And it's an electro number inspired by a dream he had about Vogue dancing pioneer Kevin Alveance appearing to him. And Matos does a really clever thing here where the song references Two Step Garage. It says Two Step Garage. I've never heard of it. It does not exist. And I think we've already talked about how, you know, we haven't been talking about Two Step Garage, which Reynolds spent a whole chapter or two chapters on. It's a big deal in England around this time. Doesn't make a big impact in the States. And this is a pretty elegant way for Matos to describe what Two Step Garage was in sort of an extended parentheses.
Yeah, it's like Eminem in that nobody listens to techno diss. It was pretty sweetly done.
Yeah, and he also works in Armin van Helden here, who Reynolds, I think, definitely kind of undersold Armin van Helden's importance. And Matos works him in. He calls him house music's bass king, and that he swiped the idea from No Beat Stops from Jungle. So he's incorporating ideas from Jungle, but into a house context. He'd had some big success with remixes in the late 90s. He did Tori Amos's Professional Window and Widow in 1996, Sneaker Picks, Pimps, Spin Spin Sugar in 1997. And he inspired things like Double 99's Rip Groove track 1997, which is called Speed Garage. So Matos traces Speed Garage back to Armin van Helden and that style of house, then talks about how London DJs would play New York garage records like Mark M.K. Kinchin's remixes like The Nightcrawlers' Push the Feelings On from 1992. And then Todd Edwards comes along, and Reynolds talked about him as well. Matos calls him M.K.'s great successor, who turned Kinchin's cut-up technique Baroque and into a complex series of crosshatch samples, creating uncanny patterns. And it's a lot like Kanye West was definitely paying attention to stuff like this, because Kanye is kind of the first hip hop producer who would sample things, even if they had a vocal bit in it, and then kind of use those. J Dilla did this too, would use these random vocal things to create new statements. And so, you know, Todd Edwards is playing with this stuff. Daft Punk cites him as a big inspiration and has him co-produce a track. But ultimately, this is just a way for Matos to mention Two Step Garage and Speed Garage and point out that it didn't really have a big impact in the States.
Yeah, it's like a little mention of that, and a little mention of kind of how house music is still like kind of doing interesting and important things while not having to devote a whole chapter to it.
Yeah, and we could also mention Circuit House and Tribal House is something that's going on around the same time that Matos basically had to cut out of the narrative for reasons of space. And we did a whole episode on Circuit House. So think of that when you're thinking about this era. That's part of the mix too, although that's happening more so in gay bars and also more so in places like Miami and San Francisco. It's not I think that's kind of something where you're missing the Manhattan club scene. If the Manhattan club scene had been super healthy, I think Circuit House would have been much bigger in New York around this time. Anyway, then he gets back into talking about this reverse migration from Manhattan to Williamsburg, talking about how Casey Spooner moved from Manhattan out there in summer 2001, that there's this random cowboy bar in Williamsburg called Lux, and Larry T. And his partner Product host their Berliniumsburg parties there on Saturdays. That goes so well, they also start hosting Friday night parties they call Mutants. It's fundamentally a gay pickup bar, but a ton of other scenesters that aren't into that are coming out for the music. And, you know, this is happening at the same time as, like, Twilo, the mega club, had closed permanently in May 2001. And then they get the idea, let's put on a festival. And it's the Electro Clash Festival. And Larry T coins that term, Electro Clash, which was controversial at the time. And does it really describe a unique genre, or is this just an electro revival?
Electro Clash was pretty fresh and new. You can't compare the electro that was coming out in the early 80s to what was going on in the early 2000s. I feel like there was too many other things going on at the same time in the new Electro Clash. I feel like Electro Clash captured that fact that it was electro plus, and if that plus was indie rock, or if that plus was punk, or if that plus was, you know, techno, which it often was with a lot of the stuff that DJ Hell was doing, then all the better. And I know that everybody hates the name Electro Clash, or everybody at the time, everybody who was involved in the scene that just didn't want to get sucked into a subgenre of a subgenre. They hated the name Electro Clash. It stuck. So everybody had to deal with it.
Yeah, and another big difference is the Electro Clash is predominantly white artists coming from these really privileged spaces. I mean, the New York art world and fashion world and, you know, Manhattan, Williamsburg, sort of just a very different perspective. Also, the gay scene is making its presence felt. So many of the key stars of this are, coming right out of the gay club scene and bringing
that. And you're finally starting to see a lot of lesbian artists getting top billing and attention as well, which I think it was a big part of Electro Clash, was just the fact that it was one of the first kind of big electronic music genres where the doors were completely wide open to women to take the lead and to do their own things.
And speaking of women doing their own things, I'm going to play our next track. This is Peaches. Fuck the pain away. Yeah, this whole episode's gonna be marked explicit because we're doing Peaches.
Titties like you wanna be calling me all the time, like Blondie. Check out my Chrissy behind, it's fine all over the time. Like sex on the beaches. What else is in the teachers of Peaches, huh? What? Fuck the pain away. Fuck the pain away. Fuck the pain away.
And that was the infamous Peaches doing Fuck the Pain Away. Tell us about Peaches and why you picked this track.
Oh, Peaches is just one of those quintessential Electro Clash artists. She's so rude and she's so over the top. It captures the snark, but the earnestness and the horniness of that entire era and period.
Yeah, and this is sort of the uptown fancy version of what was going on at Woodstock 99. There was just something going on around the turn of the millennium where everybody turned the horny dial up to about 10 and... you know, and then mayhem ensues. But back to the Electro Clash Festival. It's not just at Lux in Brooklyn. There's also shows at Exit, which is in Manhattan on West 56th Street. Also Webster Hall, which is a big venue, spread over multiple days, October 10th, October 13th. Like I said, there's an immediate backlash. I mean, people and Larry T's promoting it, putting the Electro Clash brand name out there all over the city, and people are putting, you know, somebody puts up a sign back, Electro Clash could become the next grunge. Don't let buzzwords and marketing destroy the music you love. And yeah, by this point in the late 90s, everybody had seen what happened. Like when grunge first happened, people were like, oh yeah, we won, and as if it was a good thing. But very quickly people sort of realized that popularizing underground scenes inevitably means losing all the things that people liked about the underground scenes and watching people you didn't like take them over and become yucky. So people are kind of pre-ready for that. DJ Hell is definitely not amused. And then even acts that are playing at the festival, like Adult with a period at the end from Detroit, they played the Webster Hall night with Peaches and Chicks on Speed. And they're still bitter that they're called an Electro Clash group. He's like, look, we paid the played you don't play the Puckle Pop Fest in Belgium and the next thing you know you're considered Puckle Pop for the rest of your life. Like, look, all we did was play a show and we cannot get this branding off of us. So Yeah, like we said.
I mean, it was just unfortunate because, as we mentioned earlier, like once something goes out of fashion, it's hard to kind of keep that aura of cool around it. And a lot of these groups went down in flames with Electroclash once its 15 minutes of fame were up. So they were right to not want to be pigeonholed, and they were right to be upset over the fact that they kind of got dragged down on that sinking ship in the end.
Yeah, and got more material left in this chapter than we can cover, so I'm going to kind of rush through it. He Matos talks about the summer tours that were going on. Moby puts out his own Area 1 tour. MCT management had booked his previous packages. This time it's all Moby. He gets Paul Oakenfold, The Orb, Carl Cox, Outkast, Incubus, the new metal group, a new metal aligned group, New Order, the old school new wave group, Nelly Furtado, and The Roots. So mix of hip hop, tons of, you know, Oakenfold and The Orb, kind of stock rave acts. This tour actually made money, which was a rarity in 2001. Concert sales were down 12% from 2000 for the first half of the year. Obviously, the second half of the year was a disaster after 9/11. But you had multiple big shows like Mecca coming out of Toronto and Creamfields coming out of UK that were supposed to be doing big, ambitious tours that totally collapsed. Mecca's 10-city tour canceled 3 days before their first show. Creamfields was supposed to be doing two big, massive UK-style raves, one on the West Coast, one on the East Coast, had to cancel the both things. The Long Island show only sold 6% of the tickets. Kurt X out in Wisconsin basically throws in the towel, has a 2001 show. He'd had bad shows in 1999, 2000 because of equipment theft. He tries to do a Burning Man replica in 2001, but it burns up early. There's a brawl with some bikers at the strip club during the fest, and he just basically throws in the towel. And after there's a regroup fundraiser, November 2002, they're trying to raise funds to renovate the Racine, Wisconsin's Uptown Theater, and that gets raided by the police. Am I saying Racine right? Is that how people say that?
Yeah, I think it's Racine.
Okay. But that gets raided by the police. And so X had seen what happened to Disco Donnie and just threw in the towel.
Yeah, the rave scene was just in such a bad spot. You weren't drawing from the general population anymore. You had to make do with whatever existing kind of scene was there. And that was in a constant state of flux and shrinkage and turning over and just general melting down. So, you know, there was no longer this communal vibe that you could rely on to make everything work, because it became very dog-eat-dog and very dark.
Yeah, and Steph tells us it's Racine, so Racine, Wisconsin. And then Matos uses Doc Martin, who's a DJ we've been talking about, came from San Francisco down to L.A. or vice versa, been around the scene. He uses him to tell the story of 9/11. Doc Martin had been having a very good 2001, had an Essential Mix compilation put out on him by BBC Radio 1, celebrated the anniversary of his residency at this massive club in London called Fabric. And this is a question I had for you. It says that it avoided trance and hard house, which were the big club sounds at the time. So what were they playing at Fabric if not trance and hard house?
They were playing house of all varieties. Oh. So hard house is kind of the more donkey trance version. It's got a really hard kicks and everything else like that. So they're basically saying they're ignoring all the underground hardcore rave stuff. And they were basically sticking with house and maybe a little bit of tech house.
Okay. And then anyway, Doc Martin was flying from Sacramento to New York City on September 11th. He was at the next one gate over from one of the planes that hit the Twin Towers. And then, you know, he gets on his flight, goes to sleep, wakes up and they're landing in Kansas and ends up never making it to Sacramento for that thing. And he was almost on flight 93, which was the flight where the passengers rebelled against the terrorists and crashed into the ground. So 9/11 happens in the middle of this chapter and disrupts everything. But then Matos gets into a little thing about Vice magazine, another just awful relic from this era. I mean, just listen to the names as I go through this. So this is what Matos calls Hipsterville's house organ. It's hard to imagine, but Vice magazine was actually hip at the time. It promulgated a new aesthetic, which Matos calls slickly produced cheap provocation. The infamous Terry Richardson was his starkly lit perv shots set the aesthetic. And Richardson is like the king of Me Too problems and just
booking models to sleep with them, and everything that was wrong with kind of the fashion power dynamics that would go on, where you basically had all of these models who were expected to do whatever you told them to, because you had to, otherwise you would be excommunicated from the entire scene. So Terry Richardson was the big predator, right, kind of in the middle of that greasy kind of hipster fashion scene.
Yeah, if Harvey Weinstein was a fashion photographer, he'd beat Terry Richardson. And it was obvious at the time that Terry Richardson was gross and awful, but there it was. It was massively popular. And then you had Ryan McGinley doing what Matos elegantly calls his looking for America with my rich, naked, junky friends scenarios that would be in these photo shoots. It's perfect. And then Gavin McGinnis, who's now more famous for having founded the Proud Boys fascist militia, he was doing these do's and don'ts sort of, they swiped the old format from National Lampoon's old, fashion do's and don'ts. And Gavin McGinnis is laying down the law on what's hip and cool. So one of the many problems with this era, it's decadent, and with decadence comes fascism and yuck. So
it was all about radical self-expression rather than group unity, and outrageous twat behavior was encouraged, and it was actually pretty fun so long as everyone was clever enough to pull it off, and obviously many weren't.
Yes.
And it got old fast.
That it did. Then he checks in on Tommy Sunshine, who starts an electro sweat night at Chicago at Red Dog, later moves to the Smart Bar and renames it Degeneration. He's even makes it on the cover of the December 2001 issue of what? I don't know my notes again. Apologies. I'm just off this week. The moral of the story is that cocaine is now the big drug on the scene instead of ecstasy. There's a bar in Williamsburg called Cokies, where the hipsters would go and buy their cocaine. It's just like, how does this stuff get away? But then he checks back in on the Electro Clash Festival, that the thing's such a big hit that the guest list line at the exit show on October 10th, the guest list line went around the block. So the main thing is way around the block. And Sam Valenti the Fourth passes out promos of his Tangent 2000 Disco Nouveau comp on his Ghostly International label. And he says, there was a faint echo of really interesting lost music that was coming back into view. Nowadays, it seems kind of obvious, but at the time it was a brush of fresh air. And that's true. They're bringing back this stuff from the early 80s that people had kind of overlooked and redoing it. And people like Spencer Product is performing as Prance, rewriting Prince songs. And this is the context in which Peaches is the breakout star of the Electro Crash Festival, basically because she's putting on a really passionate stage show, plus all the sex stuff that's totally over the top.
Yeah, you've got a whole bunch of artists. You watch any Electro Clash documentary and you see artists like my robot friend, who's somebody like just basically dressed up in a what was the name of that South Park costume that Cartman used to wear? Anyways, it's almost like that. Yeah. Like everybody has their ridiculous gimmick, and everybody's putting out this real kind of speak and spell electro stuff and having a lot of fun doing it. You know, you go back and listen to it, it might not hold up that well, but there is no doubt people are having a lot of fun.
Yeah, absolutely. And it also creates, because it's in Manhattan and because you had this media scene still at the time, creates this music industry feeding frenzy. And you get these two characters, we've talked about them before, James Murphy and Tim Goldsworthy. We last saw them, let's see, Murphy was an indie rock drummer from Jersey, and Goldsworthy had co-founded Mo Wax Records, the acid tracks, or jazz, acid jazz, yeah, the acid jazz label from the UK. And they start this record, DFA Records. And as Mato says, it's younger indie kids who didn't reject DJ culture. They just resurrected it on their own terms, presaging the end of the 2000s when the mass pop audience is going to do the same thing. So you've got this whole generation of indie kids, indie rocker kids who have grown up on dance music and are cool with it. And so their first big record is The Rapture's House of Jealous Lovers. And this is this is the rock track that makes the dance floors again. This is, you know, and they talk about the way that the DFA guys recalibrated the Rapture's goals. So the Rapture was a band that started with ambitions like, hey, maybe we could open for Fugazi at one of their $5 shows, all ages shows. And DFA is like, no, you could be the next Cure, which doesn't quite happen. But having a B-side remixed by Marvin Geist of Metro Area got the rock record on the dance shops and got DJs willing to play it. And Mato says, seemingly all 20,000 people who bought Jealous Lover ended up buying drum machines or becoming DJs. And then Murphy, the indie rock drummer, becomes James Murphy from the LCD Sound System. They put out Losing My Edge in 2002. Is LCD Sound System part of our story, or?
Well, I mean, I'd say that they're the perfect embodiment of electronic music and indie dance music or indie rock music kind of fusing into this new thing that everybody loves. Everybody can enjoy LCD Sound System.
I never have, but I'm not holding it against him. I never really tried that hard, but I couldn't even finish the documentary about him. But so, yeah, LCD Sound System, which even I know was a big deal. And then he wraps the chapter with Fisher Spooner's comeuppance. So far, they're just the hype. They're the darlings of the pop world, the dance world, the fashion world, the art world. They put out their single Emerge three times with three different labels. Ministry of Sound, the London mega club, has started an American record label. They've hired away DJ DB and Andrew Goldstone from F111, which was Warner Brothers' dance imprint. They're planning to reissue the number one album, which Fisher Spooner had put out independently itself. But then there's a bidding war with other labels after the Electro Clash Festival. Results in all kind of rock star nonsense, like Spooner flies the Concorde to the UK and back for a meeting. The final deal gave Fisher Spooner veto power over their US label, and the net effect of that was they vetoed so many options that by the time Capitol puts out the album in America, the UK version was a year old, and it had been 3 years since the album had come out independently. They got a $2 million advance, supposedly.
Reportedly, yes. They seem to say, that one of the many artists who say, like, we didn't see any of that.
Yeah, if somebody got $2 million, it wasn't me. It's Casey Spooner's line. That ends up, though, killing. They had a great deal with Deitch Projects, which was an art group that had them on a stipend. They were performing in the galleries. Because of this size of this label deal, whatever, that deal got killed. Labels start crashing around this time. This is the dot-com bust and the big reception. Ministry of Sound shutters their U.S. office almost as soon as they opened it. And then Matos drops the bomb into the chapter. On April 28th, 2003, Apple announces the iTunes Music Store. So,
dun, dun, dun.
Yeah,
MP3s are here to stay, baby. They've gone legal.
Yeah, sorry, American or worldwide record industry. The CD era of profiteering is over. And so on that happy note, we're going to end our Electro Class chapter. And next time when we come back, we're going to be talking about Daft Punk at Coachella in 2006. So the big comeback of EDM is next. For Ryan Harkness, I'm Nate Wilcox. We've been discussing Underground is Massive, How Electronic Dance Music Conquered America by Michelangelo Matos.
Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Rollcast and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Next week, Ryan and Nate talk about Daft Punk's breakthrough performance at Coachella 2006 and the beginning of electronic dance music's belated rise to the top of American pop. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's fantasypoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. Fantasypoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.